Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In the 1950s, the German pharmaceutical company Chemie Grünenthal released a new drug onto the market. It was a non-addictive sedative that was advertised as completely safe. It was marketed and distributed in 46 countries and became one of the world's largest selling drugs at the time. Until 1961, when it was banned and Chemie Grünenthal formally withdrew it from the market. The drug was called thalidomide.
I said, go and get my baby. And she said, oh, I can't. I said, go and get my baby. I want to see her. And she brought my baby, and I unwrapped her and poured down with tears because I could see all her limbs were affected.
Andre Bokitko told the BBC she was one of more than 10,000 mothers worldwide whose babies were born with severe limb defects after she took thalidomide as an anti-nausea drug during pregnancy. For years, Chemie Grünenthal had insisted thalidomide was safe and had a wide variety of uses. Sample packets were sent to physicians to give out freely to their patients. But it didn't take long for mothers and doctors to realize something was going very, very wrong. Here's Dr. Martin Johnson, former chairman of the United Kingdom's Thalidomide Trust.
Damage varied from day to day. If the mother took the drug on around day 20, you'd be getting central brain damage. And 21, it would be the eyes. And 22 to 3, it would be the ears and the hearing and the face. And day 24, it would be the upper limb damage. So a tablet on day 24 was capable of removing a complete pair of arms. And over the next 4 days, corresponding patterns of leg damage.
The disaster was unfolding largely in Europe. Thalidomide was never approved or marketed in the U.S. And that's because in 1960, a woman named Dr. Frances Kelsey became the FDA's newest drug reviewer.
It just so happened that my first application was for the drug thalidomide. I got this because I was new and they thought I should have an easy one to start on.
Well, Dr. Kelsey was quite concerned about the paucity of evidence for thalidomide's safety. So she withheld the drug's approval, blocking it from being marketed in the United States. Now, in the U.S., just 17 babies were born with thalidomide-related birth defects, according to the FDA, though thalidomide victims associations believe the number is likely higher. Because of a loophole in the 1938 Food, Drug, and Cosmetics Act that allowed American drug makers to distribute the drug for clinical trial. 2.5 million thalidomide pills were distributed in the U.S. for two clinical trials. Here's former FDA Commissioner Margaret Hamburg.
One very serious drawback was a provision that allowed a manufacturer to start selling a drug if the seriously shorthanded FDA failed to act within 60 days to prevent the product's marketing.
Well, knowing this and knowing the concerns raised by Dr. Kelsey, on August 1st, 1962, President John F. Kennedy issued a warning to the American people.
Every doctor, every hospital, every nurse have been notified. Every woman in this country, I think, must be aware that it's most important that they check their medicine cabinet and that they do not take this drug, that they turn it in.
In that same press conference, Kennedy also called for stronger FDA oversight on drugs before they went to market.
Now what we have to concern ourselves about is the first appreciation to Dr. Kelsey, who spared us this terrible human tragedy which has been visited on families in Germany, and to provide both administrative and legislative safeguards to lessen the chance of such action coming in this country again.
Well, 2 months later, Congress unanimously passed the Kefauver-Harris amendments to the Food, Drug, and Cosmetics Act. On October 10th, 1962, President Kennedy signed it into law. Here's former FDA Commissioner Margaret Hamburg.
The key force behind this transformation was a requirement that new drugs had to be proven effective in the crucible of rigorous scientific investigation and be approved by the FDA before they could be marketed anywhere in the United States.
So the thalidomide tragedy forever changed the way drugs are tested, approved, and marketed in the U.S.
With the passage of the amendments, FDA was no longer a helpless bystander while unproven medicines were streaming into pharmacies and patients' bedsides.
So this is the essential background to understanding the long and detailed drug approval process that every pharmaceutical must go through to make it to market in this country. It's a process grounded in the primacy of safety and effectiveness. But that very framework and the FDA's ability to regulate drugs could be in jeopardy because of a case currently being heard in a Texas court. This case is also about pregnancy. More specifically, it's about abortion. The lawsuit is challenging the FDA's drug approval process for a drug called mifepristone. It's used in medical abortions, which account for more than half of all abortions in the United States. Plaintiffs argue that the FDA did not adequately determine whether the pills are safe, and therefore FDA lacked authority to approve mifepristone. Well, the drug has been on the U.S. market for 20 years. It is also used to help women experiencing miscarriages. If the case succeeds, mifepristone could be banned. It could also undermine the FDA's entire drug approval authority. As such, the ripple effects of what happens in that Texas courtroom could spread well beyond the politics of abortion. Well, joining us now is Glenn Cohen. He's a professor of law at Harvard Law School. His research focuses on bioethics and health law, and he co-wrote an amicus brief in support of FDA in the Texas case, and he joins us from Miami, Florida. Professor Cohen, welcome back to On Point.
Great to be with you.
So I'd like to actually start with the latest in what's happened in this case, because there was a hearing held just yesterday. No recording was allowed of the hearing, but did you follow what went on in the courtroom?
You know, I've seen a little bit of the reporting. It seems to me the judge is taking the arguments of both sides seriously. I don't think he particularly tipped his hand. The first question people ask me is, when will we get a decision? And my answer is, it's up to the judge, maybe a week, maybe 2 weeks, maybe a month. That seems like a reasonable time frame is what might happen next.
Mm, okay. So let's just describe briefly in a little bit more detail, what is being alleged by the plaintiffs in this case, which is a group of essentially activist groups and doctors who are opposed to abortion. And they're claiming that FDA should never have approved mifepristone because it skirted its own requirements for safety and effectiveness?
Yeah, so they're putting forward three arguments, and pardon me, this is going to get a little bit nerdy for a minute, which is to say, but I'm sure your listeners love that. There's really three arguments. One is that there is this regulation called Subpart H, which was in place at the time this was approved in 2000, and it refers to illnesses, and the claim is pregnancy is not an illness, it's a condition. Therefore, FDA didn't have the authority. That's one claim. The second claim is that aside from whether it had the authority, FDA's review of this drug and approval, that they got it wrong, and the judge should be in a position to basically overturn FDA's expert approval on the subject. And the third claim has to do with the actual sending of the drug by the mail. There is this very old act called the Comstock Act, and the claim is by sending in the mail, that's problematic. So those are the three main claims they're putting forward.
Okay. And let's just theorize for a moment. What would happen? What could potentially happen if the judge issues, you know, a temporary injunction on the pill?
Yeah. So as you said, the parties have sought a preliminary injunction. They've asked the drug be withdrawn completely from the market. That is, as far as I know, there's never been a case where a judge has ordered FDA to withdraw a drug from a market. And the reason is because the statute that creates FDA, its organic statute, creates a whole process by which a drug should be withdrawn and really vests the authority in the commissioner. There's things to be considered. There's opportunities to be heard. And what they want is to skirt this entire process and just have the judge order it to be removed. It's possible the judge will agree and decide a preliminary injunction to remove it. Should that happen, there's going to be a set of subsequent proceedings seeking a stay in the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit, which is the court that reviews this court's decision, and then potentially up to the U.S. Supreme Court and possibly arguments on the subject.
Okay.
The practical reality, though, should it be removed or order removed, is FDA has a few options. There's a few folks that have argued that FDA has enforcement discretion not to enforce the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act against this drug. So FDA could say, you know what, we're going to announce that even though it's not authorized and it's no longer allowed to be on the market, we're not going to do anything about it. That's a possibility. It's also a possibility that there might be other lawsuits that are going on right now that come to contrary conclusions, and the Supreme Court is given a choice between those lawsuits as to what to decide.
So it sounds like it could be rather far-reaching.
It's going to be pretty messy, I think, to be perfectly honest. And, you know, this is the question about whether a single judge sitting in a single district should be able to make policy, not just any policy, but a policy that Congress has vested to a group of experts, the FDA. That's why a lot of people like me, FDA law scholars, are quite worried about the ramifications of this decision.
Mm. Is it possible, though, that the judge, and we'll talk a little bit more about who the judge is in a few minutes, Professor Cohen, but I mean, there's always a possibility that a narrow ruling tailored specifically to this drug could emerge from the court.
Yeah. So those three grounds that I spoke of at the beginning, it might matter considerably which ground he adopts. And again, it's possible the judge, as I think he should, will reject the challenge being brought here. But even if he accepts one of the arguments, it might depend which of the three. Mm-hmm. If he accepts the argument relating to the mails, that's somewhat limited to the mail and how these things are distributed. If he accepts the argument as to subpart H and this question about illness versus condition, again, we think he's wrong to do so. But at least it's limited in that way. It's really that first one, if he basically says, hey, we're going to overrule FDA on the merits of the question of whether this is safe and effective, that's the really worrisome one.
Okay. So when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about who this particular judge is in the Texas court. And we'll also hear from a former member of the FDA about really what the drug approval process is and how it could change depending on what this court decides. Back in a moment. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about a case in a Texas court that could be one of the biggest cases impacting abortion in the United States in recent years. And I'm joined today by Glenn Cohen. He's a professor at Harvard Law School, and he co-wrote an amicus brief along with 18 other food and drug law scholars in support of the FDA in this case. And in just a few minutes, we'll be hearing from a former worker at who spent almost a decade at FDA. But Professor Cohen, before we again pick in more detail into the arguments made by the plaintiffs in this case, I wanted to talk for a minute about why it's in this particular Texas court, because obviously mifepristone isn't a drug that's exclusively used in Texas. It's used all across the country. So can you talk about the importance of this particular Texas court for a minute?
Yeah. So this is a court where essentially they were all but guaranteed to get this particular judge. And that is a practice that some people call judge shopping. And again, it has to do with the fact that there are very few sitting judges in this particular district and in the Amarillo court in particular. Now, there are some folks who think that's kind of a problematic practice because it gives one side a major advantage. Now, I teach civil procedure to first-year students at Harvard Law School. I teach them the importance of choosing the right court to file something in, something that's called forum shopping. So I don't want to say that this is kind of so obviously wrong. But here, it's been a major advantage to challengers to abortion and challengers to the Biden administration's kind of policies in general to know that there is a particular place to file something where you can get a particular judge whose views are well known. And I think a lot of people are waking up to this practice and saying maybe this is a problem.
Okay. So, I mean, to your point, it may be a distasteful practice, but not an uncommon one, Professor Cohen. But the judge in particular, so we're talking about the district court for the Northern District of Texas. And the judge is Judge Matthew Joseph Kaczmarek, if I said that correctly, nominated by President Trump in 2019. He's 46 years old, graduate of Abilene Christian University and the University of Texas Austin School of Law. And he's overseen a couple of other really sort of far-reaching cases. I've seen reporting calling his courtroom where Biden administration policies go to die.
That's right. That, again, his record on this and his record before he became a judge suggests that he's not going to be particularly sympathetic to the Biden administration on abortion matters. Now, you know, as President Obama, I think, said once, elections have consequences. The president is given the authority to nominate who he wants. The Senate can confirm or refuse to confirm these people. But I do think it's really tricky to say that somebody can make a decision that will affect the entire country and affect the availability of a drug that's used in the majority of abortions in America at the moment, simply by choosing to file in this particular place rather than somewhere else.
Professor Cohen, are you saying you have a problem with legislating from the bench?
Well, my view is that essentially this is a case where FDA has been given the authority. It's not a question of legislating from the bench. It's a question of which of the branches of the government has been asked in the first instance to make a determination about the safety and efficacy of a drug. And to me, the clear answer is it's FDA.
So you gave me a very dignified response to what was admittedly a tongue-in-cheek question, and I appreciate that, Professor Cohen. But I'd like to bring in another voice now. Ava Temkin joins us from Washington. She worked at FDA for over 8 years, left her position there in 2021, and is now a partner at the law firm King & Spalding in the FDA and Life Sciences practice. Ava Temkin, welcome to you.
Hi, Magna. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so I'd love to use your expertise to help us understand what the FDA drug approval process actually is and how that flows through the claims being made in this case. So first of all, that sort of fundamental assertion that the plaintiffs are making that, well, FDA is supposed to regulate drugs that are meant to alleviate illness and that pregnancy is not an illness. So therefore, it undermines FDA's authority kind of de facto in this case. How do you see that?
Well, I will tell you, I think, you know, FDA has done a pretty good job of thinking these things through. And at the outset, I think it's important to recognize that this is a scientific question, right? Like a lot of the questions that are raised in this case, the question of whether pregnancy falls within the scope of the particular regulation that Professor Cohen was describing as an illness or condition is a scientific question. And it's one that FDA has very thoughtfully taken on and addressed. And what FDA has said is that there are a number of, you know, serious conditions that can arise from pregnancy. There are a lot of medical issues that come up during pregnancy. And so that's, you know, it's not for me to second guess that scientific judgment. In fact, I don't want to. I want FDA to make those choices.
Okay, well, but this idea of illness and its alleviation, that it should be the focus of FDA, on the face of it, it seems like an acceptable argument for the plaintiffs to make. However, I was looking at all the things that FDA does regulate and approve, both on the pharmaceutical side and the medical device side, and it seems like there's quite a bit of things that FDA regulates and approves that really have nothing to do with what one would call an illness. I mean, for example, on the medical device side, whole list of dermal fillers for cosmetic surgery. So in practice, isn't FDA's remit broader than simply just looking at drugs or devices that are exclusively focused on human health and illness?
Absolutely. I mean, if you look at the definition of drug or you look at the definition of device, and these are statutory definitions, they are, of course, broader than just illness, right? I think there's a lot of overlap in the Venn diagram between things like illnesses and disease states and conditions, and these are all highly technical things that overlap with one another. But regardless, FDA has jurisdiction over a broader swath of products, to your point.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
and
so
if I could jump, yeah, go ahead, jump in for one second say something, that is to say, it's even worse the case for the challengers than you make it sound, Meghna, because FDA has consistently used the term illness and condition pretty interchangeably in its regs, in its statutes. And also, subsequent to this 2000 kind of subpart H, Congress and FDA itself has broadened the authority. So in some ways, they're harping on a technicality that I think they're reading the regulation wrong. But even if they read it right as it stood in 2000, this is just a procedural difference. And FDA has looked at this many times since, and Congress has looked at it many times since, and has broadened the authority. So that's part of the reason why we give this argument a little bit of the back of our hand.
Okay. So I'd like to sort of ground our analysis right now in a little bit more a language that's perhaps more accessible to folks. And so, Ava, let me turn back to you, because I understand that you drove around for years with the FDA's sort of guiding documents in your car. So I presume that you know them quite well. Professor Cohen's right to point out this subpart H argument that appears in the plaintiff's case. Okay, so let's talk a little bit more about what it is, because the plaintiffs are saying in 2000, FDA approved mifepristone under that subpart H, which authorizes accelerated approval. So can you tell us what that is, Ava?
Sure. So accelerated approval is a pathway to market that in which FDA will use to approve certain kinds of drugs based on certain kinds of clinical data, right? So all drug approvals require voluminous clinical data. Traditional approvals historically have some outlines of what kinds of data they're supposed to be predicated on. And accelerated approval is a different way of getting to the same end. So it's an earlier approval based on what's called a surrogate or intermediate endpoint, which essentially means that FDA can approve the drug. And then subsequent to that approval, the drug applicant or the drug sponsor will confirm what is expected to be the clinical benefit. But I also want to point out to you, Meghna, that Subpart H wasn't just the accelerated approval regulation. It also contained regulations that FDA used to impose sort of risk maps or risk mitigation mechanisms prior to the statutory codification of what became the REMS authority. So Congress codified both FDA's accelerated approval authority and FDA's REMS authority. Both of those things were born of the Subpart H regulations.
Okay, so help me understand something, though, because if for accelerated approval, the presumption, or not the presumption, the legal basis of it was that the companies would subsequently, as you said, provide further evidence of safety and efficacy, that hasn't always happened, right? I mean, it was only in the December omnibus bill, if I remember correctly, that included fixes to a problem that has really dogged FDA, that drug makers weren't providing that subsequent data in a timely manner.
Well, yeah. So there has been a lot of debate in recent years over what some people call dangling approvals, right? And the way that accelerated approval works is that there is an endpoint that we think that the capable scientists and doctors at FDA think is predictive of a true clinical benefit. But that clinical benefit will take too long. So to do a full clinical study that measured a mortality benefit, for example, would take 10 years. And it's not considered reasonable for patients to be waiting that 10 years when we have a different endpoint that we can use to get a sense that the drug works. So the efficacy determination will be predicated on the endpoint, and the sponsor commits to doing a post-approval confirmatory study. Those post-approval confirmatory studies have come under a lot of scrutiny because in some cases they either aren't completed in a timely way or they don't demonstrate what was intended to be demonstrated. And that's something that this recent legislation that you mentioned took on and gave FDA some new authorities to grapple with. I do want to point out, though, that those issues are not what the plaintiffs are pointing to around mifepristone.
So tell me more.
Well, the MIFI approval, sorry, the mifepristone approval used subpart H to impose risk mitigation mechanisms that became what's called a REMS through sort of the history of the drug and the codification of the subpart H requirements. All of it points back to the point that we started with around whether or not pregnancy is an illness or a serious or life-threatening illness, as those terms were understood in subpart H at the time of the mifepristone approval.
Mm. Okay. So I have to say, perhaps this is my lack of legal knowledge that's making it a little difficult for me to understand exactly what's happening here. So Professor Cohen, help me with some clarification. In the 20 years or so since mifepristone received that approval from FDA, again, the plaintiffs are asserting that there's not, it's not safe. That's their assertion. But have we had subsequent analysis or studies that measure safety and effectiveness of it?
So let me put it in the most non-lawyerly terms possible, Magda, which is to say, this is a drug that has been studied probably more than almost any other drug in the United States, in part because of the huge amount of political controversy around it. We've had hearings, we've had REMS, we've had a Supreme Court case actually about one of the REMS during COVID, for example. This is not a drug that people have not looked at. And everybody seems to agree that its safety profile is better than Tylenol or Viagra, for example. It's the mere fact that it's an abortion drug, so it's causing us to suddenly consider all of these questions in a way that seems plausible for the challengers to bring this challenge to this court. But in fact, if you compare it to almost any other drug FDA has approved, it's safe and effective.
Mm. Well, the plaintiffs, though, claim that this is the claim they're making, that upwards of 10% of women who take mifepristone will need follow-up medical treatment for an incomplete or failed medical abortion, and that some 39% of women may require surgery if the pill is taken in the second trimester. And they're asserting these percentages as evidence of lack of safety. And Professor Cohen, how did you and your colleagues respond to that in your amicus?
You know, again, what I'll say is that it's FDA's job to weigh these things. FDA has weighed these many times. Congress has had many hearings. People have looked at this. The experts have looked at this. And the experts say this is safe and effective. And it's for FDA to make that determination. Mm.
Well, so Ava Temkin, another thing that is being claimed here is that over time, FDA has reduced, again, in the view of the plaintiffs, the required oversight on administration of the drug. You know, they say about a decade ago, FDA increased the gestational age in which the pill could be taken. They changed the dosage and route of administration. They reduced the number of in-person office visits required. And of course, now there's also the availability of mifepristone by mail. And that these are also in opposition to FDA's remit as regulating the safety of the drug. How often does that kind of expansion of availability happen for an approved pharmaceutical?
It's a great question, and I have to say, I mean, it's just part of the normal course of existing as a drug in America, right? Science changes, technology changes, the data. I mean, to Dr. Cohen's point, there is so much data around this drug and its safe use over 22 years that it's been on the market, you know. And as FDA gets more information, and as medical communities get more information, there are often changes made to the precise kind of ways in which drugs are used, often changes made to expand what the approved use looks like as we have data to support the safe and efficacious use of products in different and novel ways.
Mm. We've got about a minute before our next break, and I suppose I should ask just a really basic question. I should have asked this earlier, but Ava, how does FDA even define what constitutes safety in its approval process?
Well, it is a massive undertaking, I will tell you. There is a lot of flexibility built in, and we can talk more about why that's absolutely critical. But FDA's process for determining safety is a really long and involved one with an enormous amount of scientific backing. Before trials in humans are even conducted, before anyone's studying the way that a drug is used in humans, there is a lot of evidence that needs to be presented. There is a lot of science and work that is done to support even the clinical phase of developing a drug for safe use.
Yeah, because I feel like one of the challenges that FDA has is being reflected in this conversation, right? There's a certain data set that the plaintiffs are putting forward. Then you could look at another data set. Professor Cohen talked about the evidence that he and his colleagues put forth in the amicus. But it's up to FDA to kind of determine through all of this if a drug is safe or not. So it sounds like it is a complex undertaking. And we're going to talk a little bit more about what could happen to that process. Based on what may happen in that Texas court. And we'll do that when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. I'm joined today by Ava Temkin and Glenn Cohen, and we're talking about what could potentially change regarding the FDA's ability to approve and regulate pharmaceuticals in this company based on what is happening right now in a Texas court over the pill used for medical abortion. Now, this is a case that's being watched by many, many people, and not just folks on either side of the abortion debate in this country. It's being watched by the entire pharmaceutical industry as well. So we spoke to Amanda Banks. She's worked in biotech and medicine for almost 30 years, and she co-founded a biotech company and has advised multiple others and taken part in many clinical trials as a physician. And she says she knows what it takes to get a new drug approved by FDA. She says it's a long and thorough process, but one that is very predictable.
For people who are in companies who are developing new therapeutics, diagnostic products, and new vaccines, to understand the process, the regulatory process, so that when they undertake their development plans, they can account for all of the things that the FDA is going to need and require in order to convince the FDA that there is sufficient safety and efficacy associated with their products. And so it's a very well-known, no surprises kind of thing, and it offers an opportunity for stability in what's an incredibly and increasingly high-risk endeavor of developing new medicines to treat patients' illnesses.
And Banks says the uncertainty surrounding this case could potentially scare off investors who would put money into developing new drugs, billions of dollars into the industry potentially.
If they have the option to put their money into something that is already risky but has become not only more risky but less predictable, we're going to have a very hard time raising the kind of capital that's required to keep this industry moving forward. And I think for the industry, the results could be catastrophic. For patients, it stands to be even more so.
And Banks says because lack of investment could stifle innovation.
And this is where it gets much riskier, right? Because you're doing, by definition, something new that's never been done before. And you only have a little bit of validation of the science because it's very early. So you need investors that can take a long view and have a high, you know, tolerance for risk. But it's a risk that they understand. If you now throw in an unknown risk, which is despite a several decades worth of data to prove the safety and efficacy of a medicine, it can still be pulled off the market if one person disagrees, then that is a different situation and it's a very hard risk to manage.
So she's talking there about the potential politicization of almost all drugs in this country. And Banks told us that she thinks drug approval should be a question of science and medicine, not political or judicial. So she wants Congress to make sure that is very clear.
I hope that one consequence of all of this is that we get some legislative barriers around the FDA that shore up what is already sort of statutorily laid out as their mandate. And frankly, you know, protecting the right of a company that has received an approval from the FDA to sell a medicine to continue to do so.
So that's physician Amanda Banks. Now, as we've heard over the course of this conversation, the drug approval process at FDA is thoughtful, it's thorough, it takes a long time. But, and Ava, I'm going to turn to you on this because feel free to correct me if I'm wrong, but a lot of the data that FDA relies on in order to come to its approval decisions have to come from the drug makers themselves, right? Because they're the ones doing the trials. And FDA doesn't always get it right. I mean, I was just reading just this week about a drug called Makena, that was made by AMAG Pharmaceuticals. It was the only drug FDA had ever approved to potentially reduce preterm births in this country. But from what I understand, the approval for this drug was based on just one study that was published in 2003, and some physicians had some really serious concerns about it right out of the gate because there were flaws with that trial. And it was only last fall that FDA decided to backtrack, so 20 years later, roughly, and withdraw its approval for the drug. So is the process really as universally rigorous as we've been making it out to be?
I mean, It's a hard question because I can't promise you that 100% of the time anything will be right. And the Makena withdrawal proceeding that has been going on for a very long time is an example of FDA sort of grappling with, you know, maybe having gotten something wrong. But I would say that the mifepristone approval and that drug share very little in common, right? The process that mifepristone went through took years. There was enormous amounts of data to support the approval, and there was an enormous amount of data that has been generated since then that continues to support safe use. And more than anything, I think the point which Dr. Banks made very eloquently is that FDA needs to be the arbiter of this decision, right? So whether FDA wants to change its mind based on new data or based on a reimagining of existing data is a different question, I think, from whether a person who disagrees with FDA's decision about safety and efficacy can and should bring a judge to second guess that scientific decision making.
You know, but unfortunately, as we all know, politics has been injected into the FDA. It's kind of a bipartisan effort in years past, even though we ideally want it to be a nonpartisan regulatory agency. So, I mean, Professor Cohen, can you think of an example or two of how politics got in the way before?
Oh, yeah. And so, as you say, it's been bipartisan, which is interesting, right? So in 2011, FDA Commissioner Margaret Hamburg recommended that Plan B one step, the morning after pill, be approved for over-the-counter. She was overruled by then-Secretary Kathleen Sebelius of Health and Human Services, right? On that point, it was an election year. I'm sure that had something to do with it. And there's a reason why a bunch of the FDA commissioners, I think maybe 2 or 3 years ago, got together and penned something saying we want to insulate FDA even more. But I want to just kind of distinguish two questions. One is politics, Republicans, Democrats, judges being appointed by certain presidents, right, getting involved. That is something that I think is problematic. On the other hand, FDA's decisions are not just ones and zeros. It's not just data-driven in the sense that decisions have to be made about trade-offs. Take the vaccines during COVID-19. What would be the threshold for efficacy? Would we grant emergency use authorization given the pandemic we are facing? These are hard questions that are trade-offs, and there are costs and benefits to the way you go. But FDA is the body that Congress has appointed to make these decisions, and we want it making these decisions, not a single judge without any scientific training sitting in Texas.
Yeah. So we're going to come back to that in a second. But on the sort of bipartisan efforts to inject politics into FDA's decision making, actually, our producer, Paige, reminded me that back in 2014, I actually had done an interview about a governor, specifically Massachusetts Democratic governor at the time, Deval Patrick, who tried to overrule FDA's approval of an opioid called Zohydro because of the massive opioid epidemic in the state of Massachusetts. But this was a FDA-approved drug. And so the governor tried to ban it. But a month later, a federal judge ruled that the ban was unconstitutional, saying the state did not have the power to overturn a decision by the FDA. So I spoke in 2014 with medical journalist Judy Foreman about this.
To my mind, it doesn't really make sense for any governor in Massachusetts or anywhere else to sort of try to second guess the FDA, because they did, controversial as it was, they did go through a long process at the FDA, and they also did write a report saying they thought that the drug was safe and effective. Obviously, people are arguing about that, but I don't really think it's right for a governor to do it, because it really is a public health problem, not a governance problem.
Now, the then FDA Commissioner Margaret Hamburg had told Massachusetts officials she was worried about the precedent that this kind of action by a governor could take. I mean, Ava, what are your thoughts about that? Sounds a bit familiar.
Yeah. I mean, I think that Dr. Hamburg was quite prescient, right? And here we see again in the mifepristone context, states imposing restrictions on access to medication in a way that really interferes with the congressionally delegated role of the FDA. And I think the point still holds that a state really can't stand in the shoes of the FDA to impose restrictions on medication access that FDA has determined are not appropriate and that upset that careful balance that Congress directed FDA to strike.
Mm. Now, I want to underscore that this lawsuit currently going on in Texas, as we've been talking about, is about a drug that's already been approved, right? I feel like we have to just emphasize that. It has already been approved and it's been on the market for the 20 years that we've been talking about. So for a moment, Professor Cohen, again, let's hypothesize about what might happen if the judge does indeed say, no, I'm going to issue, or says, yes, I will issue this injunction against mifepristone. Could that provide the legal precedent for groups to target other drugs that are already on the market for, I don't know, say any number of things?
Absolutely. If the view is that the judge says it's proper for me to relook at the evidence and essentially overrule FDA, why not use that for gender-affirming care drugs or any other kind of drugs that might be used in controversial cases, contraception and stuff like that? So that's why I think this is such a case that everybody is watching, because it might set a very dangerous precedent.
Mm. And Ava, what are your thoughts about that?
I completely agree with that. And I think, you know, we're not just talking about controversial drugs here. There are dozens, maybe hundreds of drugs that have potential reproductive toxicities and other kinds of toxicities, right? Everything from cancer drugs to acne drugs to immunotherapies that have the potential to have some sort of negative impact on pregnancy or otherwise, right? Almost all drugs have the potential for toxicity. That is why FDA does this careful balancing between risks and benefits. And I don't think we want to be in a position where drugs can't be developed or they become too costly to develop or shouldn't be made available to patients because there might be some potential toxicity that arises. Rather, I think where the benefits outweigh the risks, and that has been determined by appropriate scientific expertise, that's sort of where we need to be.
Mm. Well, as we round towards the last few minutes of this conversation, let it be said that I think virtually everyone who's been watching this case thinks that it's likely to end up before the Supreme Court. Now, whether or not the Supreme Court decides to take it up is a different story, but it's headed in that upward direction. And so we spoke with Robin Feldman, a professor at the law school at the University of California, San Francisco. And she believes that landing before the Supreme Court was always the plaintiff's original intention.
I would say that the case is designed to appeal to the types of issues that the Supreme Court is comfortable taking. That is, it's framed in the procedural context, not in terms of the substantive value of the decision. It is carefully crafted with the justices in mind.
Professor Cohen, not just the justices, but some very particular ones who have already openly expressed disdain for the administrative or regulatory state. Am I not right?
Yeah, there's a bit of a perfect storm here in that we've got a bunch of justices who don't like the administrative state, a bunch of justices who don't like the abortion right. Interestingly, two of the more conservative justices, Justice Thomas and Justice Gorsuch, are on record being against nationwide injunctions. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. But I think, you know, it's a question about whether the court is willing to go there. It requires five votes, and whether they can count up to five is the question.
Well, so, but tell me a little bit more about really what the Supreme Court in its current makeup has said or acted upon when it comes to issues of how much should judges and states be allowed to control or undermine regulation versus the protection of, you know, federal agencies.
Yeah, so we have, I would say, several broad battlefronts on the administrative state. There's a question of deference to the administrative state and to agencies. That's sometimes called the Chevron Doctrine, and there's been pushback on that. There's something called the Major Questions Doctrine, which is whether you believe Congress intended to give this to an agency at all. And then there's just a general kind of skepticism of expertise, and we saw this a little bit in the OSHA mandate case about vaccine mandates last year, I think it was. So I think all of these are kind of aligning with some anti-abortion feeling on the Supreme Court in a way that makes this a particularly good moment for the challengers to bring this case.
Ava Temkin, I keep in mind that we purposefully started this show with the story that led to FDA's expanded power to regulate and approve pharmaceuticals in this company. And that was a global medical disaster because of thalidomide. Now, could any weakening of FDA's oversight open the door to, I don't know, I hope we would never go back to that, but just chaos in terms of determining how do we even determine what is safe in this country?
I hope not. But I think we have to seriously consider the ripple effects of the, you know, depending on what the judge in Texas does, really having some drastic implications for drug development, and also whenever drug development is affected, for patient access, right? It's really important to remember here how much it matters to people to have the FDA imprimatur of safety and effectiveness on all of their drugs. And I think what we don't want to land in a place where that changes, where that FDA approval is less meaningful to patients, less meaningful to drug companies, less meaningful to investors, all of those things, right? FDA has been the arbiter of safety in drugs for almost the last 100 years, and people really count on that.
Well, Ava Temkin, she worked at FDA for more than 8 years and is now a partner at the law firm King & Spalding in the FDA and Life Sciences practice. Ava Temkin, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And Glenn Cohen, professor at Harvard Law School, who focuses on bioethics and health law, co-wrote that amicus brief along with 18 other food and drug law scholars in support of the FDA in the Texas lawsuit. Also co-author of an article in the New England Journal of Medicine just this month called Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine versus FDA. That's the case's name. Dobbs, Collateral Consequences for Pharmaceutical Regulation. Professor Cohen, always great to have you.
Thank you so much.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.